Hi, everyone. This is Bill Knauer, and you're listening to Author, where one writer talks to another writer about writing and life, because what it takes to write the book you most want to write is also what it takes to lead the life you most want to lead. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video and audio interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org. And we are funded by the Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. To learn more about the PNWA, as well as their outstanding yearly writers conference, please go to pnwa.org. Well, you know, some writers teach because, well, they've got to make ends meet, and no one can blame them for that. But some writers teach because, well, they have to teach. And I think that is the case with today's guest, Laura Munson. Now, Laura is a crackerjack writer. She wrote the best-selling memoir, This Is Not the Story You Think It Is, and a Season of Unlikely Happiness. But recently, she has also begun her Haven writing retreat, and I'm so glad she did, because she's a natural-born leader and inspirer. And I'm just so glad she started it, and I'm glad she's on the show with me today to talk about writing and teaching and whatever else we want. Laura, welcome to the show.
Hi, Bill. How are you?
I'm splendid, Laura. It's so nice to talk to you. It's always good to talk to you.
I agree, but I need to know before we start what a crackerjack writer is.
No, I don't know, but I heard that term once to describe Jason Alexander as an actor when he was on Seinfeld, and I thought, I love that as an adjective, as a superlative, and so I use it sometime. It's a superlative. It means just excellent.
Can I use it?
Yeah, please. Let's start.
Okay.
It's a good thing to be a crackerjack writer. So, you know what's funny, Laura? I was thinking about this prior to our little chat here, but you and I had a phone conversation not long after your book had been out for a little while. And for those of you who haven't read it, do so. It's wonderful. And it got a lot of attention. And it's a memoir that a lot of people thought was maybe about marriage, but it was really about learning how one's happiness cannot and does not exist outside oneself. Would you say that's an accurate portrayal of the book, Laura?
Yes. Marriage is the entry point. A marital crisis that I was going through. But you're right, it's really about emotional freedom and about how we can choose how we react to what people say and or do to us, that there is this little gap wherein we get to choose. And so I had learned from years of being rejected by the publishing world that it was total insanity to define my happiness based on things outside of my control, i.e. getting published. And when I finally flipped my thinking and started to take responsibility for the way I thought and responded to, namely rejection, that's when everything happened. So what I'm really after is emotional freedom and cultivating that in my own life.
Well, it's critical, and really it's what everybody in the world is seeking in one way or another, I think. And so it wasn't surprising to me when we were talking one day and you were surprised to find that a lot of the sort of, I don't know what call this community exactly, but the teaching community, the sort of Deepak Chopras and I don't know, Eckhart Tolle's of the world, were sort of inviting you to come teach because you had written a book about this very experience of flipping that paradigm. And you said to me, I don't want to do this. I'm just a writer. I don't want to go talk to these people about these things. And I thought at the time, he's going to talk to those people about these things because that's the way she is. And has that begun to happen, in fact?
Yes. Thank you for knowing me better than I know myself, Bill. I have been on the speaking circuit, and I love it. And so I've spoken at women's conferences or in front of writers in colleges and high schools as well. Trying to take this message to the road within the context of creativity, because I'm not a life coach, I'm not a therapist, but I do know that my creativity is my lifeline. And for many people, it's the scariest place that they can go. And for me, it's been, you know, what I hold on to in the hardest of times and what I preserve. I say that my writing is my meditation, my prayer, my way of life, and sometimes my way to life. So in the case of the book I wrote my way through a crisis. And I think it's because of that that people feel like they know me, they feel like they're with a trusted friend. And so that gives me the position that I'm in, and that's to be able to hopefully speak with people and glean some level of wisdom from my experiences. But that's, you know, the speaking stuff is something I love to do. I was a theater major, and a lot of writers are very reclusive and introverted. I'm not, just like you. I'm not. But I have small children, and it's hard for me to fly and leave this little town in Montana for speaking gigs. So I've decided that what I really love to do most is help people with their creativity, hands-on, roll up the sleeves, and really dig in. So I've started these retreats out here called Haven Writing Retreats, and I'm having a blast doing them.
Okay, so I have never myself been to a retreat. I've never retreated, but if I were to go, is it for women only, or do men come also?
Well, it's open to anybody of any gender, but it's mostly women that show up. But I do have one man on the next retreat in February.
One of my showed up. Okay. Well, so what would I find if I go there? If I go to a retreat, what happens? Just basically.
Well, what happens usually is a very interesting trajectory. People show up very high and excited because they've come from, I mean, I've had people from Australia and Paris and East Coast, West Coast, North, South, everywhere. I live in the very northwest corner of Montana, and so it usually takes a couple airplanes to get here. So they're tired after a long day of traveling, but they're also incredibly excited because they've taken this stand for themselves and their creativity. Some of them are published authors. Some of them haven't written anything but their Christmas card. Some of them are working on a book and aren't published. So the retreat is designed to meet you wherever you are. And that's, I think, why they get so excited, because they know that they're going to be in this nurturing, safe, inspiring, and I hope challenging environment. So it's a three-day retreat, and we divide our time between writing classes, which are very informal. They're all about just playing on the page. We do exercises that I've designed to help you kind of get unstuck and have breakthroughs wherever you are in your creative journey. And then we also take ourselves out of our heads and into our bodies in the afternoon, and we do different sorts of things like equine-assisted learning and yoga and meditative walks.
Yeah.
And they're all designed to mirror what we do in our morning class. And then in the evening, we do readings. So each day, everybody gets a writing prompt, and they can do the prompt during the day in their free time if they want, and share it in the evening, or they can read from a work in progress, or just choose to be a listener. And it's all tucked in the beautiful, stunning wilderness of Montana at a wonderful ranch that I have come to love very deeply.
Yeah.
So,
well, it sounds great.
It's a powerful experience. Yeah.
Well, and I love the idea of retreat, because I do feel that most of what challenges people who want to write has nothing to do with writing technically. You know, I mean, if you've ever read my column, you know that I tend not to focus on the sort of nuts and bolts of writing, although that's important to know. But there's so much else that can infiltrate. Well, for instance, just the thought of rejection can affect the simple creative act, can't it?
Absolutely. And, you know, almost every single person, no matter where they are in their creative journey, says to me in an email beforehand or on the phone, because I do like to talk with people on the phone to let them know what they're signing up for, they'll always say something to the effect that I'm not good enough, or I'm sure
right.
I'll be the worst writer there, or, you know, I'm not a real writer, or,
right.
you know, my family all thinks I'm crazy that I'm taking time away, you know, from my kids. They think I'm being selfish, or, you know, there's a lot of negative stuff that people show up with,
yeah.
and that high from the first day sort of tanks on the second day, and
right.
people start to think, what have I gotten myself into? And then by the time they leave, I swear I see these beautiful breakthroughs that happen in people, because where in life do we stop, unplug, and give ourselves the opportunity to really dig into our creative minds and souls in a nurturing way. It just doesn't happen. And also, I think I get a lot of bloggers who mm-hmm. are spending all their time working on their blog, but aren't making the time to work on a book that they want to write, for instance.
Right. Right.
So those, there's a lot of bloggers that show up here, or people. I had a woman who showed up who wanted to write a memoir about herself as a young woman to give to her adult sons so that they
okay.
would know who she was.
Yeah.
And
what did you do with that?
She said, well, she's writing, we decided, the whole group, that it wasn't just for her sons. It was
uh-huh.
for anybody who wanted to be known.
What a surprise.
It's usually what people lead with. You know, one woman came and said, just so you know, I hate people and I hate writing.
Oh, good. I hate people and writing.
I said, what are you doing on a writing retreat? She said, I have no idea. I read your book and I just wanted to come. I'll tell you what, that woman walked away with a book outline, the first chapter, and a title, and she's currently working on it and hoping to get it published.
Wow.
So it's an interesting thing to watch, and it's an honor to facilitate what goes on at these retreats.
I love it. You know, I started doing a thing once a month called the Authors Roundtable, where I do it at this bookstore here, and people can come, and we're not going to talk about craft. We're going to talk about why we aren't writing, why we could be writing more, what are we dealing with here? And I wanted to create at the roundtable just what you're talking about, which is a nurturing environment. And I think it's critical because I think writers can be immensely unfriendly to themselves. They can
mm-hmm.
sometimes be unfriendly to each other. Certainly there have been people who have probably had nightmare writing group experiences. And I think it's so important that people learn how, and it sounds like you're teaching them, to be able to transport the nurturing environment you're creating there in Montana back to their desks, because that's when the silent cruelty can kick in, can't it?
Exactly, and that is the hope. And I say that the first night, that this whole retreat is designed so that you can take what you learned here and bring it home to your writing space or into your lives, or, you know, as you're standing up at the baseball field watching your kid play. It's this awareness of how we are in our own way, the negative talk that we hear in our heads. And, you know, I had one woman who showed up with a book that she'd been working on, and she ended up throwing it into the fire, into the campfire. Because when you get into a group setting, you really see where you're in your own way, especially if it's in such a nurturing, loving, positive construct. And so actually in the morning classes when we do a lot of this sort of improvisational writing, mm-hmm. there's no commentary and no critique. So there is truly a safe haven for you to explore. There's no right, there's no wrong, there's no good, there's no bad, and there's no criticism or commentary. In the evening, people can ask for commentary, constructive criticism, if you will, after they do their readings. But in the morning, that's my favorite part, because people really, you know, this is another interesting point. I do a lot of these exercises with the kids in the school. And when I take them to the fourth graders, they are so free because they don't have rules. They're not worried about good, bad, right, wrong. You know, they're just so close to their creative souls. When I bring it to the high school kids, they just look at me perplexed, like, I don't get it.
No, that's when it sets in. That's when the self-consciousness and all the editing and all that sets in.
Yes, I know. It's so true. So I've got one of the groups is writing, they're co-writing an anthology that they're going to publish on Amazon. And another group has a weekly Facebook page where they go. It's just a private group, and they do some of these writing exercises together and help each other. So something happens when a group of people gathers, even if it's somebody who says they're totally antisocial. The bond between the people, like I'm sure it's the same at your round table, is really profound.
It is, because writing is such an intimate experience. You have to go, you know, one of my favorite quotes from a book called A Course in Miracles is the line that goes, and this is one I keep unfolding and understanding more and more as I get older and just a little bit wiser, is that in our defenselessness, our safety lies. And I believe that's absolutely true. And as a writer, you can't really have defenses. You can't protect. There's nothing to protect. And one of the great gifts to me as a writer, especially as I've written about my own life, is that there is nothing that I have nothing to fear if I can tell the truth. There's nothing to be protected. And when you do that in a group, the closeness that can evolve can happen quite rapidly.
Yeah, vulnerability is my favorite word, and I've always said I don't want to be your friend unless you are willing to be vulnerable.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of why I have met, and I hope this has been your experience too, so many sisters and brothers in words and heart since my book has been published. That's been one of the greatest blessings from it all, is just meeting other people who are willing to bear their souls on the page in a responsible way. And I just got off the phone with Kelly Corrigan, the writer of The Middle Place. We're doing a gig together in San Francisco in the first week of April. And she was saying the same thing, that she's met only truly nurturing, kind people. And I think if that's what you're putting out there, that's what you attract.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. It's absolutely true. And I have found for myself when I've done, I call it teaching, but it's, I don't know what, you call it facilitating. I guess it's trying to help offer people a perspective that could be of use to them. But as you've done these retreats, how have they affected you? What's changed with you as you've begun doing them?
Well, that's such a great question. I've told you this before, and it's in my book, but for anyone who's listening out there who hasn't heard this, a couple of years ago, I wasn't getting published, and I was very frustrated with the whole experience, sitting here day in and day out writing and writing and writing and not getting anywhere in terms of publication, really. And so I wrote an artist statement, and that's something that we all do on the retreats. Everybody walks away with an artist statement. And it was, I write to shine a light on a dim or otherwise pitch black corner to provide relief for myself and others. And Bill, that really surprised me, because I never understood that I was writing from a place of service. I never, ever thought that. And it totally has changed the way that I write, because I am now considering the reader. And it's a very big piece of why I'm doing these retreats, because I want to give back. I don't want to be a teacher standing behind a lectern at the front of a room. I don't want to be put on any kind of pedestal. I want it to be us, not us, them. And
right.
So that's why I really do feel like a facilitator. Like, I designed the retreat that I would want to go on, and it's like, I'll take the torch, I'll put my hand out, put your hand in mine, maybe I'm a little bit braver than you, but not by much, let's see where we get together. And I do all the exercises, too, so I'm putting myself in. We do it all, we all do them together, and we all read them together. So I'm on the hot seat, too.
That's good. Well, I love what you said, and this is so important. You know, the best advice for writers, I think, or one of the best pieces of advice, is always write the book you wish you could read, which is very much what you did with your memoir. You wrote the book not just that you wish you could read, but you wished existed, that you needed for that time in your life. And I think the same has to be true of anything you create, if it's a retreat. What's the retreat you would go on? Because you, that way, can see the value, know the value in what you're creating. And if you create the thing that you know is valuable, other people are bound to be drawn to it.
Yep. Yeah.
And that's what you do in your writing.
Excuse me?
That's what you do in your writing, too. You say, what is valuable to me in reading? Let me create it in my writing.
That's right. And that's another bit of self-talk, destructive self-talk I hear from a lot of people, that, you know, it's like, well, I want to write this book about, you know, my father's time in the military, but so many books have been written about that, and how could mine possibly be any better or different?
Right.
And I constantly say, in fact, one of the exercises that we do, it's a scene, and there are four different characters, and I tell them what the four different characters are, and somebody walks in and has a grenade in their hand and says, I give up now, and then walks out, and each of the people on the retreat have to write each of the people's experience that were in this cafe when it happened. And the idea that I'm trying to impart upon them is that nobody can experience it the way that you can experience it. So write your story, whatever it is. And if you write it true and if you write it responsibly and with all that vulnerability, then your voice simply is unique no matter what. It's not possible to write somebody else's book, which is actually, I've been asked to do some ghostwriting in the last couple of years, and I say no every time, even though, you know, it's lucrative financially. But I don't think I could write somebody else's story. I don't know how. Could you?
I couldn't do it. I did know one guy, though. Donald Bain is his name, and he has ghostwritten over 100 novels, including the Jessica Fletcher mysteries. But he loves it. See, he likes being assigned. It makes him comfortable. And so for him, he just thrives in it, and he absolutely loves it that way. But I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it because I need to listen to that voice that tells me what to write, and it doesn't usually come from outside of me. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I suppose it's the ultimate act of empathy to be able to write somebody else's story. And I like to think of myself as a person with great empathy, but I don't know if I'm that good.
We're all on assignment, but it's just a question of who. Which actually brings me to my next question that I think I'm wondering if it comes up at the retreat, but this has been one that's been coming up lately for me at the round table, which is the issue of the imagination. Because whether you're writing a memoir, and even memoirs are an act of imagination in terms of reimagining what has happened before, you know, it's not happening in the moment you're writing it, that this relying on your imagination theoretically to make money is a very challenging thing for a lot of people because it's not there. It's not physically in your hands. It's not even knowledge in a way. It's a thing that visits you. You listen to it. You respond to it. You translate it. But it's more like a relationship. And I feel that that's also one of the great challenges facing creative people, that it's not like just learning accounting and doing it. It's like learning a relationship and trusting it.
Yeah, interesting.
Does that come up at all?
Well, I don't know if this is an answer to your question, but a friend of mine who is a reviewer contacted me before he gave my book a review, and he said, I want to know if you wrote your way through that crisis and you wrote the book during it or if you wrote it after, because that's going to make all the difference in the review I give you. And I was sort of afraid of answering that question, and I said, well, I wrote my way through it. And he said, okay, then I'm going to give you the review that I'm giving you, which was a rave review. He said, because I don't believe in being paid to have experiences. And I disagree with him, because writers are always writing, no matter what. And if somebody is savvy enough to say, I want to go travel the world and write a book about it, will you give me a six-figure advance? And the answer is yes. I don't think that taints the experience if you're a true writer, because you're always mining your life. You're all, everything that you've got this filter as a writer that is always about the writing and relating with the world and trying to make sense of it. I think it's Annie Dillard who says, I write to understand.
Yeah.
And I do too. I think we all do. That's why we're so obsessed with this craft that has us sitting staring at computer screens alone all the time. And I don't know if that answers your question about imagination, but I do think that that if your intent is pure and you really know what your author statement is, then I think you're going to go down the road you're supposed to go down as a writer.
Yes, and I think there's nothing wrong with getting paid to have experiences and writing about them, because you're absolutely right. I feel, and this has been true of all the writers I've spoken to who we've talked, where we've discussed it, that writers do need to write something down to understand it. That it's not the same to have it in your head. That somehow that translation into the definite words you choose teaches you what it is you actually know and what it is you actually believe. Because didn't you, you must have had that experience in writing, even though you were writing your way through that marital crisis. The writing of it must have taught you something about that that you didn't quite fully understand until you wrote it.
Of course. Well, and, you know, there was speaking of reviews, there was another review that was sort of negative that was, you know, this is a journal of this woman's experience of blah, blah, blah. And I take issue with that word, because nobody would want to read my journal from that time. A memoir is still crafted. It's still architectural. And I think it was it Faulkner, somebody, Melville, somebody fabulous and famous that we all read in high school, said easy reading is damn hard writing.
Yeah, I've heard.
And so when people say, you know, I read your book in a weekend or in one sitting or whatever, I take that as such a compliment because that reflects years and years of hard work at my craft. And I sometimes consider the idea of memoir to be, well, a lot of the people that show up on my retreats, for instance, love to write in their journals, and they want subsequently to write a memoir. And I really encourage people to write in their journals, but a memoir is not a journal.
No.
And people need to understand that, you know, if they have a story they want to tell and they like to write in their journal, that doesn't necessarily mean that they need to write in the nonfiction voice. They can just as easily write in the fiction voice. And I encourage people, if they have something very personal to write, to consider fiction instead, because you know, it's pretty hairy being out there with your personal story, and the fan mail you get from it and the press you get from it is very different than if you'd written a novel.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And the thing is that when you write a memoir, you're writing, it's you know, a journal, if it were to be published, would be, it's really your life told in a story. But a memoir is a story that uses your life. You're creating a story from your life. You're not trying to tell people your life. It's not your life story. A true artistic memoir, I think. You've said my life is the stuff that I'm going to use to tell this story that I hope will be of use to you in some way. That's why whenever I write my little blogs, my essays, when I'm writing my column, I always think, how could this thing that happened to me be of use to someone else? How can I translate it so it could be of use to someone other than me? And that's always sort of my measuring stick.
Well, you're writing from a place of service as well, then.
Indeed I am. It's true. Can I tell you a funny story? Laura, when I decided to write No One Is Broken, I was like just sick of it. I had this great agent. He was trying to sell this fiction book, but it wasn't selling, and I was absolutely sick to death of writing the thing. I knew I couldn't go back to it. And I was pacing around my living room saying, okay, Bill, if you could write anything at all, what would it be? And immediately I had this picture in my head. And it was me holding something out away from me as if I was giving it to someone. This is just an image in my head. And I said, what is that? I said, oh, it's a gift. I'm giving someone a gift. I get it. And I said, what's in the gift? And that's when I heard the title to the book, which is No One Is Broken. I said, okay, that's what I got to write. But that's how it came to me, is like, give them a gift. And I thought, I want to do that. I want to give them a gift. I don't want to just try and publish a damn book. I want to give them a gift. And it made all the difference.
The ego steps out of the equation when you start to think about the work being a gift. And that's another really confusing part for a lot of people to all of this, and that's how do you take your creative life, which is hopefully pure and, you know, in our case of coming from a place of service, and turn it into a business? It's very difficult for a lot of writers to become, you know, money savvy around this, and it's something that I struggle with every day. How much time do you allot to promotion? How much time do you just promote to your craft? You know, I mean, I think this is a huge issue for creative people, and it's a big, for me, it's a big component of stepping outside of the tortured artist paradigm to look at it like, okay, well, I will spend this amount of time working on my book, this amount of time on my blog, this amount of time doing social media, which is a wonderful platform, but can be, you can go crazy with it, you know.
Well,
we all know that. Again, that's part of why I think the retreats are so powerful for people, because they're unplugging. And by the way, speaking of plugging, I have February's full, but I have some space in June, August, and 2 dates in September if people want to attend. And all that information is on my website at lauramunson.com.
lauramunson.com. Go there, you people, if you want to retreat. I can think of no one better to retreat with Laura. I should have booked an hour with you. The time was too short. Good luck on this retreat and all the other stuff you're doing.
Bill, you're wonderful. Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, everybody, find a nurturing place. Nurture yourself. Be kind to yourself. You can't go wrong when you do it. Take care. Write what you love. Love what you love.